Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Martin here with Richard Martin's Wake Up Call this fine Monday, the 17th of November, where the weather is just spiffy here in Miami, and I hope it is pleasant with you too. Well, I thought I'd start today with a new study by sociologists at the University of Maryland, which concludes that unhappy people watch more TV, while people who describe themselves as very happy spend more time reading and socializing. And the study, by the way, appears in the December issue of the journal Social Indicators Research. Analyzing 30 years' worth of national data from time use studies and a continuing series of social attitude surveys, the Maryland researchers report that spending time watching television may contribute to viewers' happiness in the moment, with less positive effects in the long run. Quote, TV doesn't really seem to satisfy people over the long haul the way that social involvement or reading a newspaper does, says University of Maryland sociologist John P. Robinson, the study co-author and a pioneer in time use studies. Quote, it's more passive and may provide escape, especially when the news is as depressing as the economy itself. The data suggests to us that the TV habit may offer short-run pleasure at the expense of long-term malaise. End of quote. Based on data from time use surveys, Robinson projects that TV viewing might increase significantly as the economy worsens in the next few months and years. Quote, through good and bad economic times, our diary studies have consistently found that work is the major activity correlate of higher TV viewing hours, Robinson says. As people have progressively more time on their hands, viewing hours increase, end of quote. But Robinson cautions that some of that extra time also might be spent sleeping, quote, as working and viewing hours increase, so do sleep hours. Sleep could be the second major beneficiary of job loss or reduced working hours, end of quote. In their new study, Robinson and his co-author, University of Maryland sociologist Steve Martin, set out to learn more about the activities that contributed to happiness in people's lives. They analyzed two sets of data spanning nearly 30 years, 1975 to 2006, gathered from nearly 30,000 adults. A series of time use studies that asked people to fill out diaries for a 24-hour period and to indicate how pleasurable they found each activity, and a general social survey attitude studies, which Robinson calls the premier national source for monitoring changes in public attitudes, in-depth surveys that over the years consistently asked subjects how happy they feel, how they spend their time, among a number of other questions. Robinson and Martin found that the two sets of data largely coincided for most activities, with the exception of television. From the general social survey, the researchers found that self-described very happy people were more socially active, attended more religious services, voted more and read more newspapers. By contrast, unhappy people watched significantly more television in their spare time. According to the study's findings, unhappy people watch an estimated 20% more television than very happy people, after taking into account their education, income, age, and marital status, as well as other demographic predictors of both viewing and happiness. Data from time diaries told a somewhat different story. Responding in real time, much closer to daily events, survey respondents tended to rate television viewing more highly as a daily activity. Quote, "What viewers seem to be saying is that while TV in general is a waste of time and not particularly enjoyable, quote, the shows I saw tonight were pretty good," Robinson says. The data also suggested to Robinson and Martin that TV viewing is easy. Viewers don't have to go anywhere, dress up, find company, plan ahead, expend energy, do any work or spend money in order to view. Combine these advantages with the immediate gratification offered by television, and you can understand why Americans spend more than half their free time as TV viewers, the researchers say. Unhappy people were also more likely to feel that they have unwanted extra time on their hands, 51%, compared to very happy people, 19%, and to feel rushed for time, 35% versus 23%. Having too much time and no clear way to fill it was the bigger burden of the two. Martin likes the short, temporary pleasure of television to addiction. Quote, "Addictive activities produce momentary pleasure and long-term misery and regret," he says. "People most vulnerable to addiction tend to be socially or personally disadvantaged. For this kind of person, TV can become a kind of opiate in a way. It's habitual, and tuning in can be an easy way of tuning out." There we are, ladies and gentlemen. Take your places in the line and make your decisions. All right, so here we are, Richard Martin, Richard Martin's wake-up call. The toll-free number, which I always exhort you to call and give your views on, it's, as I say, toll-free, and it's available for the rest of this hour. And the number that you would call is 888-873-4643. Let me repeat that once more. 888-873-4643. Also, of course, you can allow your thoughts to materialize by way of an email, which you may do by writing to the following email address: rmartin@gscorporation.com. Let me read that once again. The letters GS stand for Global Strategic, and the word corporation should be written out in full. Once again, the email address, rmartin@gscorporation.com. If you would like to call me personally with your personal issues, you may also do that by calling on my direct line at 305-357-5575. Once more, the number to call me directly, 305-357-5575. Okay. Excuse me, and now I'm going to let you know the opinions, the thoughts, the observations of a certain John Whitehead. And John Whitehead is none other than a former Goldman Sachs chairman. And he was speaking at the Reuters Global Finance Summit on Wednesday. And because of what he says and who he is, I think it's worth taking seriously. And does, of course, dovetail onto what I have been telling you, ladies and gentlemen, for at least a year and a half. The economy faces a slump deeper than the Great Depression, and a growing deficit threatens the credit of the United States itself. Now, Whitehead is 86 years old, and he said that the prospect of worsening consumer credit woes combined with an overtaxed federal government make him fear that the current slump is far from over. He said, "I think it would be worse than the Depression. We're talking about reducing the credit of the United States of America, which is the backbone of the economic system." Well, obviously, Whitehead encountered plenty of his own crises during the 38 years at the investment banking firm and was a young boy during the 1930s. He warned that the country's financial strength is at risk due to the sweeping demand for tax relief and a long list of major government spending plans. And I quote, "I see nothing but large increases in the deficit, all of which are serving to decrease the credit standing of America." Whitehead, by the way, was chairman of the Lower Manhattan Development Corp after the World Trade Center was destroyed during the September 11th attacks. Whitehead helped make Goldman a top-tier Wall Street firm, led its international expansion, and left in 1984 to become Deputy Treasury of State under Ronald Reagan. He warned that the country's record deficit is poised to balloon as the public calls on government for more support. This is what he said. He said, "Before I go to sleep at night, I wonder if tomorrow is the day Moody's and Standard & Poor's will announce a downgrade of U.S. government bonds. Eventually, U.S. government bonds will no longer be the AAA credit they have always been." He said that there are at least $10 trillion problems facing the United States, including Social Security, expanding health insurance, rebuilding infrastructure, and increased spending on green energy. At the same time, the public doesn't want to pay for it. Quote, "The public is not prepared for increased taxes. Both parties were for reducing taxes, reducing income to government, and both parties favored a number of new programs, all very costly and all done by the government." End of quote. Whitehead also said that large deficits can weaken the country's credit and increase its borrowing costs, which already constitute a significant part of funding to cover expenses. He said it could take several years for the current problems to be resolved. He said he is speaking out on this topic because he is concerned no lawmakers are against these new spending programs and none will stand up and call for higher taxes. Quote, "I just want to get people thinking about this and to realize this is a road to disaster. I've always been a positive person and optimistic, but I don't see a solution here." Well, I guess we just soldier on, ladies and gentlemen. As you know, I read voraciously. And I assure you that I will come to you with any changes in my recommended investment posture. Sometimes I will be right, and sometimes I will be wrong. And the fact that I've been very right recently should not detract from your understanding that there will be times when I am wrong. So whatever you do, don't come to look upon me as, you know, your panacea, your answer to all the problems. I'm getting a large number of emails from people who are very grateful to me, and that's always very gratifying, of course. But please keep me as a person in perspective. Nobody is right all the time, and I want you to be very aware that I am human. Judging by some of your emails, I sometimes wonder if I really am human. But I assure you that when I pinch myself, it actually hurts. So I'm concluding that I am indeed a human. All right. Well, let's take a couple of the listeners' emails. And we'll start with Robert O'Connor, who says, "Richard, in response to your request for feedback with respect to your presentation of facts and figures, then yes, please give them to use. The facts and figures are well presented and described, a job well done. You have a rather unique ability to present the data within the context of your discourse. The meat of the show, though, is your priceless insights and understanding of the data and its impact. And he says, I was wondering if your discussion related to the potential government seizure of IRA 401k accounts was your major announcement. Because as I had said, and I continue to say that I'm about to make a major announcement. It will certainly come in the next few weeks before the end of the year, but I cannot tell you exactly when. I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, you will not have heard such an announcement before, but I am not in a position to make it right now. I'm just trying to whet your appetite. Anyway, so that's Robert O'Connor, and thank you for the kind words. Another email comes from Kevin Sierra, sent on the 13th of November, which was last Thursday, after the end of the show, so I couldn't air it then, and here it is. Richard, thinking about the effect of China's $500 billion stimulus plan on the US dollar and interest rates, with $2 trillion in currency reserves, it seems kind of obvious that they should sell about $500 billion of the U.S. government bonds they own to raise the money. Issuing a lot of Chinese government bonds or just printing up the money doesn't seem to make sense when you have that much money in the bank. Unless I'm missing something, that much selling of U.S. government debt, along with the hundreds of billions in new bonds being sold by the U.S., could send interest rates to very high levels. I was also thinking, if markets saw the Chinese government selling U.S. debt, this might lead to a sudden fall in the value of the dollar. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on this. Thank you, Kevin Sierra. Kevin, yes, I have made this point several times in the past, but it's worth making again. Please remember that the enormous, monumental sums of money that some of these foreign countries, especially Japan and to a lesser extent, China and to a lesser extent Japan, have on hand on deposit in the United States, binds them in a lock, really, because if they start to sell those holdings, that in itself will bring the value of the dollar down, and by association, therefore, the value of the rest of their holdings in the United States. See, they're not really concerned so much about the value of their own currencies, because the cost basis of their products is so much less than that of countries in the developed world, so that it really wouldn't matter if their currencies made quite a substantial increase in value. They would still be competitive with countries such as the United States and Europe in terms of their exports. But what is a severe concern to them would be if the value of their foreign holdings was to fall. And that, I think, is why they really haven't repatriated their money into their own currencies. And I think they're not likely to do so to any great degree for a long time to come. So it is true that they purchase U.S. government debt when they buy assets in the United States. And of course, given that that purchase is a fairly constant function, or it has been up until now, it has tended to keep interest rates low because it's kept bond prices high through their purchases. And as you know, bond prices and interest rates go in opposite directions. Now, what I think will make interest rates rise is the reduced purchase of United States and other foreign government assets, such as their bonds. And of course, if there's an increase in the selling of bonds by disparate forces both within the United States and outside, then obviously bond prices will fall, interest rates will rise concomitantly, and it won't really much matter what China does. They will not have any control over the fall of the currency or the rise in interest rates. So these facets are sort of multi-sided, and I don't think that one can look at any one given aspect of monetary policy and blame it for everything which happens. Anyway, thank you for your email. We come to a rant from Frank Devlin, no less. Been a while since we've heard from him with a rant, but his rant is entitled "With Apologies to Steve Kruger." A rant. Richard, Ron Paul made a very interesting point in a video done about 10 or 15 years ago. He stated that inflation was immoral. His example was a milk farmer who diluted his milk to increase its volume. This is obviously cheating the buyer who is buying the milk but getting water. We need to think of inflation in the same way. Our labor gets us money or purchasing power at an agreed upon rate of exchange, so much sweat for so many dollars. It is immoral for anyone to dilute that purchasing power by printing more dollars, thereby stealing from us, just as that farmer was stealing in the dilution of the milk. A majority of this country considers themselves to be a moral people, as is evident in such things as the moral majority and the many religious organizations. Perhaps we have become too jaded in accepting as a norm the dishonesty of Wall Street and the financial industry as a whole. Since we connect our money supply to this sorted group, we don't tend to think in moral terms, but only in legal ones. It is time the citizens of this country protested loudly against the immoral, even if not illegal, behavior we are subject to. Robbing Peter to pay Paul is still robbing. Don't vote for thieves and let them know you know who and what they are. One definition of insanity is continuing to do the same thing you're doing now and expecting different results. By that definition, our present fiscal practices are not only immoral, they are nuts. Regards from the foxhole, Frank. Thank you, Frank. Well, I guess we might as well move right in to Steve's rant, which is two lines long. Because I just opened it, and I was expecting a 10 or 15 line wonder, but here it is with our two lines. He says, Richard, I guess that after that TV survey, Alan Greenspan will now be taking the credit for giving our population countless hours of workless time with which to devote to watching TV and sleeping. Perhaps Uncle Al will bless us with another book on the subject of free time and how we should spend it. What a public servant who could ask for more. Signed, Otto. All right, thank you very much for that. That sounds to me like a worthwhile rant there, Steve. Babe, we heard from Babe last week, I believe, and Babe is back. Hello, Babe. Babe says, and the subject is, people are taking out cash from banks and putting it in safe deposit boxes. Is there any credibility to what they're doing, and what sort of climate would precipitate this kind of action? That's a good question, Babe. I think the answer is probably obvious right now that there's really no need to panic into safe deposit boxes. But what I think would create a marker for that kind of thing is if we are seeing sure signs that the government is moving into hitherto unacceptable areas of interference in people's lives, and I think more particularly in that respect of commandeering people's IRAs and 401ks, which we talked about as a possibility for the future. If it really seems like the government is muscling in on things like that, I think that one seriously has to consider the next step. And in as much as one is considering probably now the step that has been promulgated by an analyst to whom the government listens about these 401ks and IRAs, one wants to keep an eye out on similar things that can happen to cause one to believe that the government is really trying to take over people's financial and economic lives. It is, to me, a very serious consideration that the government might be moving to rescue or to bail out General Motors. Quite apart from the protectionist concepts involved, in basically an errant departure from free markets and the idea of installing protectionist policies into government policy in general. I think that it's most unfair that you think that, you know, where General Motors, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about this, but, you know, where General Motors has employees the same as any other company, you know, one has to wonder, you know, what other companies might feel they're entitled to a bailout too. Why would the employees of General Motors need a bailout and not the employees of Circuit City, you know, or Linens and Things, other companies which are going bankrupt at the same time, or any number of these mortgage companies, 250-plus mortgage companies, why wouldn't they be entitled to a bailout in the same way as General Motors? You know, we'll talk a little bit more. I have a bit more to say about that later on in the show. Thank you very much for that. Well, what do we have now? We have a question from Jonathan Stokely on deflation. He says, you've mentioned on several occasions that the country is in a period of deflation. Where do you see salaries going? Will businesses be asking employees to take lower salaries, and will starting salaries be reduced? What do you see in this area? That comes from Jonathan Stokely. Jonathan, you're in for a shock, a big shock. You know, we're not going to be talking about salaries. We're going to be talking about people getting whatever they can, basically, for menial labor. Salaries, I think, will take a big hit. I think unemployment will soar over the next few months. And, of course, that means that, you know, the minimum wage will very definitely be a minimum wage, which is used by more and more businesses to compensate or to remunerate their employees. If you look at some of the stories in the Depression of the 30s, people who had been earning, $6 or $7 an hour were earning $1.50 or $2 an hour just in order to pick up some money to buy food with for the next few days. I do think that we are looking at a very, very serious and grim economic time ahead, where, of course, you know, work will be meted out by means of barter rather than the offering of salaries for particular particular jobs to be done. So I don't think we're looking at, you know, a little small adjustment down in salaries here. I think we're looking at a major realignment of pay, and this, of course, will bring in the government meddlers trying to keep salaries high, and thereby preventing many people from getting jobs because the employers simply will rather go without the work done rather than pay people salaries that they know they can't support through their sales. So it will be very grim indeed. Your question is well taken, and your answer, frankly, cannot, I think, be quantified at this point. We will have to wait further down the line for further clarification on this. But anyway, thank you very much for your question, Jonathan, and keep the questions coming, ladies and gentlemen. We have a few couple more here. Mark Bruns came in on the 13th, last Thursday, after the show was over, with the following email entitled Obama's First Act. He says, Dear Richard, besides doing nothing, what would be the best thing for Barack Obama to begin with in his first 100 days to address the Depression, and why? Keep up the good work, Mark in New York. It's funny that you should say besides doing nothing, Mark, because frankly, you hit it on the head. The basic problem that I think anybody needs to consider when asking what a government can do, because frankly, what you're really asking, I think, Mark, is where should Barack Obama give money? Where should he bail somebody out or rescue somebody? Because in the absence of providing money or creating laws to prevent financial services shenanigans, and doing things which don't have much to do with the economy, much more to do with the sort of social issues involved in what's gone wrong, on a practical level, the government can do nothing. If the government really wants to get this thing over quickly, it will do nothing and allow the market to find its own level, which will include allowing companies such as General Motors to go bankrupt and to reconstitute themselves if they can. And if not, obviously, they go out of business. But to meddle and to try to artificially create some form of economic stimulus will never work. It never worked in the past, and it will never work in the future. Because, as I said to you before, if you do not have the creation of money based on real wealth, if you just create money based on the idea of the fractional reserve lending syndrome and the idea that money is just added to people's bank accounts to make them feel richer, then they will indeed feel richer, but it will not end well, any more than it did when people thought their houses were rising in price and value. Yes, they were rising in price, but they were most certainly not rising in value. And I used to say to people, if you think you're going to sell your house and buy another one and feel good because you sold your first house at a very inflated price, remember that the cost of the other price will also, the house will also be inflated in price. So you're not going to gain anything in the longer term. The only way that you will gain is if you cheat the system, and cheating the system means you sell your house and then do nothing. Keep your money in cash. That is the equivalent of social cheating, because you're not allowing yourself to undergo the kind of losses that your friends and neighbors and family are experiencing, and therefore you've sort of got one up over them, and that won't make you a popular person, but it will allow you to survive. And that's basically what I do here, is I try to get people to take actions which are not particularly popular, but at least they will allow you to live to see another day. So do bear that in mind, Mark. When you're asking what people should do, sometimes doing nothing is the best course of action, and that's as true in everyday life as it is in the financial world. And nothing could be truer right now. Thank you for the email. Babe is back with another email, I assume in response to my own comment on the first email. Babe said, people are taking cash out of banks and putting in safe deposit boxes. Oh, it's the same email. I don't know how that came up again, but it did. So we're going to delete it, and now I believe that we have caught up. So let's have a look right now at what's been happening in the recent statistics, and sort of comment on those a little bit, because we have been seeing some pretty stunning declines in the various monthly statistics that we follow, not least the retail sales and price of goods imported to the U.S., which last month dropped by the most on record, which in itself indicates that the economy is probably in its worst slump in decades. Purchases fell 2.8% in October, which was the fourth straight decline, and by the way, that comes from the Commerce Department in Washington. Labor Department figures showed import prices dropped 4.7%, which points to the certainty of deflation now. I don't think anybody can any longer argue that there is inflation in the system, but it was very hard to make that point 3 or 4 months ago, when the price of oil was going higher and higher, and the price of food was rising by leaps and bounds. It was almost heresy to suggest that we were actually looking at just a bubble, and that bubble would burst, and that really what we're looking at is deflation in the system. And the great economist Kurt Riechebecher, he said exactly the same thing before he died so tragically 18 months ago. He talked about the nitty-gritty of the economy, the very hub of what the economy is all about, indicating sure deflation ahead, and nobody was taking any notice, and nobody was listening to the statistics, and nobody was following the way in which the government monthly figures were being grotesquely distorted and lied about. Now, of course, it all becomes clear, and the revisions of the government figures are telling the same kind of story. So there we go. In that context, we have an email in from Ed Gomez, entitled Inflation Deflation Question. He says, Dear Richard, I understand we're currently in a deflationary period. If the U.S. keeps increasing the money supply, will we eventually suffer an inflationary period? The example that comes to mind is Zimbabwe. Thanks, Ed. Ed, I've talked about this on many occasions here. I'll gladly talk about it again. But, you know, Zimbabwe is not a major world economy. It doesn't have a major world hard currency. And so the idea that people would simply abuse the currency and get away with it is not hard to understand. People were buying things in the currency, and the country was just shamelessly printing more and more currency without any thought for the economy. And that's what caused the hyperinflation. And they could get away with it because nobody else cared less. Nobody bought anything in Zimbabwean dollars. Nobody sold anything internationally in Zimbabwean dollars. And so it was really not an issue that anybody lost any sleep over. The U.S., however, still, for better or for worse, has the world's reserve currency, they are not actually increasing the supply of money as much as you may think, because for all the dollars they're putting into the system, dollars are disappearing on the other end by virtue of bankruptcies, defaults of one sort or another, foreclosures. I mean, basically money is disappearing faster from the economy than it's coming in. And so, you know, really, it's not an issue right now. I don't think it will become an issue either, because I just don't think that you can push money into an economy where people simply cannot buy. And that's what the government's been trying to do. It's been trying to allocate this slush money, otherwise known as the rescue money or bailout money, to the banks, exhorting them to lend it out to consumers. But the banks balk. They won't lend it out, because why should they? The consumers are not good for the loans. The banks have already been have taken a hit from consumers. Why should they turn around and take another hit? And so, you know, governments cannot force banks to lend money. And whatever Ben Bernanke said, you can't go out there in a helicopter and simply drop the notes from the sky. That's not a reasonable proposition either. So I don't think it's going to happen, Ed. I don't think you have to worry about that. There are other much more serious things to worry about, I think, than whether the government can successfully inject money into the system for the use of its citizens. Anyway, moving along here, as we know, Circuit City filed for bankruptcy. Best Buy said that sales were down. And gave lower guidance even for Christmas. Nordstrom's cut its profit forecast for the third time this year. It's really a perfect storm for retailers. You know, consumers are having a negative wealth effect as stock and housing prices have plunged, taking almost $20 trillion out of U.S. consumer assets. Unemployment is rising. Consumer confidence is at the lowest level since the last major recession in 1980-82. The unemployment numbers, which came out this week, were particularly grim. Jobless claims on a seasonally adjusted basis were 516,000 newly unemployed. But that masked an even deeper actual number of 540,000. The largest previous number for this week was back in 2001 and was 420,000. And you remember how bad things were right after 9/11 in 2001. You know, obviously, weekly numbers can be volatile, but this kind of an increase is very grim and very disconcerting. Continuing claims are now roughly 3.5 million people who are getting unemployment insurance. Well, let's assume that each week we lose an average of 400,000 jobs. That's 20 million jobs in 1 year. But what happens when we see the number of new unemployment claims start to rise to an average of 500,000 for a period of time? So without more job creation, that will mean an increase in unemployment of 1 million people in just 10 weeks. This week alone, we have seen an increase in continuing claims of 141,000 from just last week. That is a very grim statistic, ladies and gentlemen, and I assure you it's going to continue. Unemployment is likely to continue to rise throughout most of 2009, closing in above 10%. This time of year should see some seasonal rise as retailers begin to hire for Christmas. But with retail sales down and facing the likely prospect of negative growth in Christmas sales for the first time ever, seasonal employment is evidently not responding. Now, here's something that I wanted to talk about, by the way, which is of great concern to so many people, and it's about the U.S. dollar. And people, the higher the dollar goes, the more people, well, they say, you know, obviously the dollar is very overvalued, it has to fall. And why isn't it falling, and what's going to happen, and etc. I have mentioned this on several occasions. I mentioned why the dollar is rising, but I thought I would flesh that out a little bit more and try to give you a rationale as to why the dollar is rising, because I think it's important for you to understand when people say, oh, we should buy the Canadian dollar, or we should buy the euro or the yen, because obviously, you know, there's so much devastation in the American economy, and so obviously, you know, the American dollar must fall at some point. Well, look, the trade deficit is dropping slowly. That is something which is quite clear from the figures. It was over $60 billion in July. It was $56 billion in September. Import prices fell, and imports were down by 5.6%. Now, on a less positive note, exports, which had been one of the bright spots in the economy, fell last month by 6%, but the trade deficit would actually have been another $3 billion less if Boeing had not been on strike. Oil prices, as you know, were an average of $104 a barrel in September. Well, probably didn't know it, but they were coming down, and for November, prices will be closer to $65, if not less. Maybe closer to $60 as the way oil prices are going now, down at least one-third. This means that the possible trade deficit for November could be a lot closer to $40 billion, which it will be the lowest since 2003, and well off the highs of almost $68 billion a few weeks ago. Now, why is that important? What has that got to do with the value of the dollar? Well, first of all, it means that a lot fewer dollars are now going into the world economy. And demand for dollars is rising as the world seeks a safe haven in the current global recession, so it shouldn't be a surprise to see the dollar rising. Now, you've obviously noticed, you know, the violence, the amazing rapidity of the rise. We're seeing movements in currency prices in a week that would normally be worth a year's worth of volatility. It's a sign of the severity of the crisis, actually, the wariness of the traders that prices are so volatile. But secondly, it also means that fewer dollars will be coming back into the U.S. to finance the rising government deficits. Now, this is counterintuitive, but it is nonetheless true. Dollars which go abroad must eventually find a home, and that home is going to be in U.S. assets of some kind, usually government bonds. Remember, you can't spend dollars outside the United States, so they have to come back. Now, as I said earlier on today, China or other large countries could stop buying U.S. bonds with their dollars. They might, for example, want to increase their holdings of euros. But what that means is that they take the dollars and sell them to someone who has euros, which means that that country now has dollars that they must then do something with. It's not as if the dollars disappear. The only way for China and any other country for that matter, to reduce the dollar balances they have, is to stop selling products to the U.S. consumer or to buy U.S. assets like stocks or real estate or wheat, thus bringing the dollars back into the U.S. But what practice? What happens in practice is that China and most Middle Eastern countries on a net basis buy U.S. government-backed debt. But you see, if there are fewer dollars going abroad, that means there are fewer dollars to buy newly issued debt. And the American government is issuing new debt at a very startling rate. The estimates for the deficit next year are close to $1 trillion. But if the trade deficit is only $500 billion, that means that the appetite of foreigners for U.S. debt will be less than half what is needed to finance the deficit. So where does the difference come from? Well, U.S. citizens and corporations, primarily banks, are going to have to buy the difference, or the Fed will have to monetize a portion. Or rates on longer-term debt could go high enough to entice foreigners to buy U.S. debt once more. But you see, higher rates would be a drag on the U.S. economy, and especially the housing markets, and would also cost the taxpayer a lot in additional interest rate expenses. Remember, total government debt is now $10.5 trillion, with the public, including non-U.S. holdings, having $6.3 trillion. The average interest paid on that debt is just over 4%. And for the fiscal year 2008, which ended on October the 31st, the interest expense was $451 billion. Well, add another $1 trillion, and the interest paid would soon rise to $500 billion. The United States is going to face a very serious problem in 2009, ladies and gentlemen. Tax revenues are going to take a very serious fall. Remember when capital gains taxes would produce a few hundred billion? Not in 2009. And income taxes are going to drop as unemployment expenses rise. The perceived need for government stimulus will be offset by the problem of the funding of the deficit. Resorting to monetizing the debt is a nuclear option. Expect even more volatility in the currency and interest rate markets next year. Now, in addition to all this, let's talk about some of the problems I've talked about before in the past few months. Roughly 3% of GDP growth for 2002 to 2007 was from mortgage equity withdrawals and other debt. That stimulus is gone. Consumers are going to start saving once again, taking money from a consumer spending-driven economy. Taxes are likely to rise, not only at the federal, but at the state and local levels, as governments of all sizes are faced with the growing deficits and needs. Financial institutions are deleveraging at a very fast pace. It is, frankly, as if the economy at large was facing a massive margin call. This quarter alone is likely to see a negative growth number of 4% or more. We are hitting the reset button on consumer spending. We're going to some lower level of consumer spending, and corporations and governments are going to have to adjust their budgets. Corporate earnings will be under pressure for a long time to come, ladies and gentlemen. I think it was Hyman Minsky who taught us that stability breeds instability. The more stable things are, the more comfortable we are with taking risk, which ultimately creates the conditions for recessions and depressions. Now, this time we took on a whole lot more risk than usual, which is why we are now in a depression. The credit crisis and housing bubble are not problems that can be quickly or easily fixed. It will take time. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've got about 10 minutes left. Let me give out my phone number. Once again, if you feel like calling in, please call in right away with a question, and we'll see what we can do. The number is 888-873-4643. Once more, 888-873-4643. Well, let's talk a little more about General Motors. I promised to bring them up again in the talk, and now I think it's the time. You know, all of us have known for many years that General Motors was essentially bankrupt. They have owed more in pension obligations than it seemed likely they would ever be able to pay without major restructuring of the union contracts. Many others were of the same opinion too, by the way. Actually, not that many. But enough people drew attention to this, which should have made us all sit up and take note. Well, now that assessment is common wisdom. Bloomberg last week cited sources that claim a collapse of General Motors would cost taxpayers $200 billion if the company were forced to liquidate. The projections also called for the loss of millions of auto-related jobs. GM, Ford, and Chrysler employ 240,000 people. They provide health care to 2 million, pension benefits to 775,000. Another 5 million jobs are directly related to the three auto companies. GM has 6,000 dealerships, which employ 344,000 people. According to a recent study by the Center for Automotive Research, if the domestic automakers cut output and employment by 50%, nearly 2.5 million jobs would be lost and governments would lose $108 billion in revenue over 3 years. How did we get to a place where the market cap of GM is a mere $1.8 billion and its stock price has dropped from $87 in early 1999 to $3.10 today? Where Rod Lash of Deutsche Bank has a price target of zero for GM. And I quote, "Even if GM succeeds in averting a bankruptcy, we believe that the company's future path is likely to be bankruptcy-like," end of quote. The litany of reasons is long. At the top of the list are union contracts which mandate high costs and pension plans which cannot be met. Then there is the problem of many years of poorly designed cars. We can also discuss poor management and bloated costs, like paying multiple thousands of workers who are not actually working. General Motors is structured for the 50% market share they used to command, whereas now they only have 20%. Wilbur Ross, a well-known multi-billionaire investor, was on CNBC saying that allowing General Motors to go bankrupt would throw the country into what sounded like a depression. He said that America as a nation is to blame for General Motors' problems because we do not have a national industrial policy. The U.S. allowed other automotive companies to build plants in states that had lower labor costs, and that's the reason GM is uncompetitive. GM pays an average of $33 an hour, and those selfish other companies pay a mere $19 plus a host of benefits. Ross evidently believes that because some states have lower taxes and right-to-work laws, that is the responsibility of the taxpayer to give General Motors a certain type of immortality rather than suggestive that General Motors deal with its problems directly. Well, such thinking is obviously nonsense and is also, by the way, unconstitutional. We have somebody, I don't know who, I'm trying to read the IM here, Frank from New Jersey. We have time for a quick call from Frank. How are you?
Hi, Richard. I'm fine. You just mentioned something, and I realized I am not thinking correctly. You were talking about the shortfall between the bonds and the ability of people to and the trade deficit, and you said that the government will have to monetize the debt. I always thought they did that by selling treasury bonds. Am I wrong?
No, absolutely not. But, I mean, that's chicken feed in terms of what they actually will have to do on a net basis. Because don't forget that every time they monetize, when they monetize debt, they're also redeeming debt that comes due as well. So very frequently it's a zero-sum figure. But we're talking about a massive, massive process of putting, let's say, government work projects into play, for which of course would require, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, and that would have to be paid for. And the most likely way of doing that would be, of course, putting out bonds on the marketplace, you know, on a net basis. So that, I think, is a possibility. Yes, I think that might happen. But so far, the amount of money being lost in other ways, overwhelms completely the amount of money that the government is creating right now. So I don't
right.
think that's
so. So the process will be, whether it's treasuries or other kind of bonds, the process for monetizing the debt will be to issue bonds, and they will probably be forced to issue them at higher interest rates to do this.
That's the theory. Yeah, that's exactly correct.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure, Frank. Thanks for the call. Just very quickly, a few more words about from General Motors. I think it's instructive to analyze, to examine the question of General Motors, because so many other companies are miniature examples of General Motors. So to see something on a macro level like this probably allows us to see a little more clearly into the consequences of, you know, saving companies and banks and financial institutions and state governments and individuals and housing related problems, right, left, and center. You know, obviously General Motors going bankruptcy would not be a good thing, but it certainly wouldn't be the end of the U.S. automotive industry. General Motors might even restructure. The shareholders will get wiped out, but since they're down about 95% anyway, that's largely been accomplished. Remember that this has already happened with airlines and steel companies and, you know, tens of thousands of other companies. You know, it's part of the process of creative destruction, which I've mentioned before, and we'll doubtless have occasion to mention again. You know, the pension plans are the real owners of General Motors. They're the entities with the largest obligations and the most to lose, and the biggest stakeholders in the successful GM itself. You know, give them the responsibility for making a new, leaner, meaner General Motors with realistic union contracts. Otherwise, you know, they will lose most of what they have. The factories will need to be closed. You know, auto sales are down to 11 million cars a year, the lowest since 1982. You know, we've run out of time, unfortunately, but, you know, there's a lot more to say about this, and if any of you have your own ideas, do feel free to email or to call in. Anyway, I'm afraid, as all good things, we have come to the end, and it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to talking to you again on Thursday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. This is Richard Martin at Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, saying bye-bye till then.